HF bands, I mean, the if you start calculating the amount of boom length that you would need to get true gain that you'd have, the lengths of the booms would be just absolutely ridiculous. That's why when you're looking at a lot of these three-element beams, tri-banders and things like that, and they're giving you big gain numbers, it's really not the case. So everyone's like, well, why do those Yagis on HF work better than the dipoles? For exactly the reason that you just mentioned, Dick. It's the side null. Many times when we get on these HF bands, what's happening is it's not the gain that we need to get to the other side or the person that we want to speak to. It's that it's all the noise, like over, you know, a kilohertz or so away on the other side. And when we rotate the antenna around, we find the happy medium between the notch or the null on the side of the beam to what's in front of us, and be able to squawk out some of the noise, and then be able to do some DXing. This is very, very common with beams in the HF band because of the limitation of the length of the booms. So we're really, the biggest benefit to those antennas really is the notch, not really the gain. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
I got another question about that.
Yeah, his advantage was the notch and the adaptability in polarization and the combination. As he rotated polarization and as he moved the notch around, he could null out that strong guy from Ohio when he's listening to London. And there were certain polarizations where he adjusted the antenna depending on the state of the ionosphere and the state of the Con Ed power in his neighborhood of Manhattan Beach, where sometimes he's getting arcing of a transformer somewhere and making noise. Again, he had full X-axis, Y-axis, and Z-axis rotation capability. Therefore, he could look for the best combination of signal-to-noise ratio, signal-to-QRM ratio, while listening to his buddy in London. And so, who in the world would think you could get a stronger signal-to-noise ratio out of this tiny antenna on 80 meters in his hand, in his basement, compared to a full one-wavelength loop 60 feet in the air on four towers? And there were times when he got a stronger signal-to-noise ratio in the basement. Of course, that sounds crazy. He was doing it over and over again, and when he told people about him, they would ask him, what are you smoking? They wouldn't believe him. N2 Moon Bounce, K2RIW. Go ahead, Barry.
Okay, so it begs the question. If you made two of these loops and you separated them by, I guess, a quarter of a wave or something like that, couldn't you also have a front-to-back ratio with this thing?
Absolutely. And the nice thing about front-to-back ratio, you don't have to go as bad as half wave. With careful tuning, and you will get a lot of interaction between the two, you could probably use in the vicinity of eighth of a wave between the two if you had proper mechanical layout. In other words, if you made believe there was a boom between the two, and if you now aim the boom in the direction of the guy that you want to null out, and you properly tune those two loops, you could make a null off the back that's an easy 20 decibels down. So you can create a significant front-to-back ratio with proper tuning of two loops, probably as close as eighth of a wavelength, Barry. N2MB, that's not giving you a whole lot of gain. It's giving you a great big null, making a good front-to-back ratio. N2MB, K2LIW.
And I don't want the gain. Well, I do want the gain, but I'll settle for being able to hear the guy. And that's going to be my next project. That's why I ask you that question. An eighth of a wave, even on 75 meters, is not a big boom. So, you know what I'm thinking.
Yeah, if I did the mathematics right, I think an eighth of a wave is 32 feet. And that's doable. So, you could mount that on top of a tower if you wanted to. And with proper tuning of those two loops, you can get a very significant null off the back. With careful tuning, I think you could get a 20 decibel null. And there are times when that would be very handy. And it wouldn't be too difficult to actually put the equivalent of a Alliance rotator on this thing, so you could rotate it in polarization. So now you can rotate it in azimuth, tune out that null off the back, And your next question, you didn't ask it, but you're going to ask. Let me drop. You're going to ask me, can you electronically steer the null a little bit away from the 180-degree point by adjusting the proper phasing between those two loops? Can you make the null become two separate nulls, a little bit to the left and to the right of the 180-degree point? I think the answer is yes. I think you do a little bit of electronic tuning of the position in space of that null. I'm going to study that one a little bit more. But you've got the resources, and how's it? I know that your tower is now Aeromotor or something like that is the brand name of the tower. I keep forgetting the brand name. By now, that tower must be in the vicinity of 40 years age, and you've done a lot of repair. Is it in moderately good shape today, Barry? N2MB, K2LIW?
KC2QIQ with a comment.
Barry first. Go ahead, Barry.
Yeah, it only needs some cross braces. Some of them, they were wire, and they rusted. But I'm going to be taking care of that in the spring. Too cold out there right now. Yes. And I'm very seriously thinking about that. I may not put it on the tower. I may put it on the roof. I've got a little tower on the roof, and I think I'm going to put that particular antenna on the roof. A little easier to work on it, you know, because I could reach it. And back to QIQ, because obviously he wants to get something. So I'm going to stand by N2MB. Thanks a lot.
You got it, Glenn. Now wait for the beeps.
2MU.
MU after Glenn. Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, Dick, actually, this experiment we've already done, a couple of my friends, myself, we've been actually doing these experiments with antennas, loops, dipole elements at different wavelengths above ground. And unfortunately for Barry, it may not be worthwhile putting it on top of this tower unless this tower is somewhere at least a half wavelength off the ground. So in other words, where you start seeing true polarization and real notching effects better than your basement is at the 150-foot mark. But unfortunately, from your basement to about 150 feet, there isn't much difference. So doing it in your basement or your backyard to about 150 feet, you'll see the first order of magnitude. To really get it to work where the notches work the way that you just said, Dick, it has to be at almost 250 feet, a full wavelength above ground. And that's actually been verified already. K2IW, KC2QIQ.
Which brings the next question, Dick. In the spring, you know where I'm going to pick up some old tower sections, and you know where they're going.
Glenn brought up a good point, and that is that the signal you're getting from Ohio that you want to null out is not necessarily coming directly above the horizon. It's coming to you at some particular elevation angle. These two loops will give you a beautiful null, but that null is going to be essentially collinear with the boom. Now, I think there's ways of electronically tuning the null a little bit off to one side, in which case it's going to be a not a point null, but a conar null. It's a whole cone in space. And can you steer that cone enough to pick up the elevation of an 80-meter signal from Ohio? Maybe not. However, if that boom of yours has an elevation control on it, and the forward lobe, you aim it into the ground, so to speak, which means the back lobe, the null, is now up in the air at the direction of arrival of that signal from Ohio, I think you can null him out without being a zillion wavelengths above the ground. It's going to take a little bit of experimenting to find out. There was a person who just signed in, which was blank 2NU. Give me the full call and name. K2LIW. Go right ahead.
Good evening, Dick and everybody in the group. Just a quick question. I'm listening to this, fascinated with this explanation of the Yagis, and I guess I misunderstood all these years. If you could just explain, if you're not receiving on the back end of that Yagi, you have a notch there. So now when you're transmitting, doesn't that mean that power is radiating forward and you're getting a beam effect? So the energy is not going out the back, so it's intensified going out the front? Or is it just independently notching out that back side of the dipole and not increasing the front gain? I was always under the impression that it's kind of acting like a a flashlight bulb reflector. If not, just if you can clarify that, and thanks for these explanations. Really enjoying it. K2MU, Bernie.
Very fine, Bernie. Good common sense would lead you to believe that the null off the back is lacking a parabolic reflector or a corner reflector, and you're getting gain off the front. Good common sense. Unfortunately, no. With this simple antenna that we're describing now, two loops with a certain spacing between the two and a certain phasing between the two, you do get a very sharp null off the back. If you could see the full three-dimensional antenna pattern, it would look like an apple. You've got a, where the stem goes into the apple, you've got a null in that one direction. It's a very narrow band null. And so the total amount of energy that's in that null that you're now reflecting forward is a couple of percent of the total energy you're transmitting. Let me drop. So the presence of that null increases the so-called forward lobe by a few tenths of a dB. In order to get a lot of gain out of an antenna so it looks like a pencil beam, you've got to take all of the energy you would have reflected, you would have radiated into the rear antenna hemisphere, and all of that energy of the rear hemisphere has to all be going forward. By the time you build a whole lot of directors, a good reflector and a whole bunch of directors on a Yagi, you do that. All of the, if you've done a real good job of tuning the Yagi, all of the back lobes can be 20 decibels suppressed. In other words, only 1% of the energy that would have ordinarily been in the back hemisphere, and that hemisphere is 180 degrees of azimuth and 180 degrees of elevation in the back half of the sphere of the antenna, you take all of that energy and properly aim it forward. And it takes real estate to do that. It takes a whole bunch of directors and a reflector along the boom to do that. You take all of that energy and reflect it forward, and now you've got some real gain. But a simple two-element interferometer giving you a narrowband null like this apple pattern, no, you don't get very much extra gain out of that. Let me drop. And try not to confuse transmitting and receiving. All antennas of reasonable construction that don't have active amplifiers inside and circulators and other exotic things, all reasonable passive antennas must obey the law of reciprocity. What that really means is that whatever pattern, whatever characteristic you measure on transmission, main lobe beamwidth, front-to-back ratio, front-to-side ratio, polarization, side lobe amplitude, nulls between the side lobes, all the things that you measure on transmission, you'll get the exact same number performance on reception. All good antennas do that. So in some cases, you can picture the antenna. Let me drop. In some kinds of antennas, like in the case of a parabolic dish, you can easily see the real effective capture area with your eye. It's the parabolic dish that you're looking at, or the corner reflector. So in some cases, like the dish, it's easier to picture the antenna in the receiving mode, and you can easily see its area, and you plug that area into the formula, gain is 4 pi A over lambda squared, A is effective area, and you know the gain of the antenna. Certain other kinds of antennas, like an interferometer, two antennas side by side, giving you a peak in the forward lobe and some nulls off to the side. In some cases, it's easy to picture that in the transmit mode and figure out what's going on. But whichever mode you figure it, as long as you do it correctly, transmit or receive mode, you figure out what the antenna is doing in three-dimensional space, you now know what it's doing in the other mode, transmit versus receive. Does that make a little more sense, Bernie? K2, Mike Uniform, K2LAW in the TechNet.
Yes, it does, Dick, and I have to say, I feel like I was just told there's no Santa Claus there, between that and Glenn bringing that up, and all those years I was working my Mosley TA-33 Junior thinking I was making a beam with gain, and only to find out it was an illusion all that time. Well, you live and you learn, so back to you, thanks, and we'll be reading the mail. K2RIW, K2M.
Now, hold on now, Bernie. What made you think that your three-element Mosley beam was not giving you real gain? What was the claim of gain on that antenna? And it's possible the manufacturer was telling you the truth. Back to you, Bernie.
I believe it was claimed more or less 8 dB or 8.5 dB for most of the bands there. It was like 60 decibel front to back ratio, but 8 dB. But yeah, I guess that's something. But Glenn's comment and your comment too, I hadn't considered the antenna in three dimensions, you know. I'm an extra, but I'm really a novice. I'm just an amateur at electronics and mostly self-taught, so I've made, you know, some big mistakes there, and leaving out three dimensions when it comes to antennas is one of them. So if there's gain there, I guess, I don't know, maybe you could tell me where that gain is coming from, if that's considered a lot of gain, but basically the boom length is only about 12 feet, so you're not getting the Yagi effect is what I understand.
Okay, the Mosley beam you're talking about, was it a three-element beam? You told me it's got a tall fill boom. And are you talking about 40 meters, 80 meters? Or, pin it down for me. What band, 12 feet of boom, did it have three elements? Was it claiming 8 dB over ISO? Over to you, Bernie, K2LIW.
The TA-33 Junior, 10, 15, and 20. And I don't recall exactly, but more or less 8 dB across the three bands, I think. Maybe probably more on 10, you know, a little less on 20. But, boy, that thing worked great, let me tell you. So there you go. Let's say on 20 meters, where I did a lot of sideband on 20 meters with that thing, I just assumed it was giving me a lot of gain, 8 dB. Is that considered a lot of gain, 8 dB? Or was that mostly the notching effect?
Okay, 12 for the boom, 10, 15, and 20, TA-33 Junior. I should know, I don't know. On each one of those bands, was it a three-element Yagi? Maybe on 10 meters it was a four-element Yagi. Do you happen to know how many elements are used on any one band at a time? Bernie, go ahead.
It's three elements. There were traps for each band, 10, 15, and 20.
Okay. I've done a whole lot of tuning of three-element Yagis. And I know that 6.5 dB over ISO is easy to get. 7.5 is possible. 8 is a little bit high. So maybe they were fibbing by a dB or so. One of the dirty secrets is that on many, many antennas, the true gain is set, the advertised gain is set in the advertising department, not in the measurement laboratory. And the reason for that is because antenna manufacturers have realized that many a guy selecting an antenna, he's looking at four different brands, and he wants to get the greatest number of decibels per dollar. So therefore, they want to make sure that they claim a little more decibels than their competition. And that has gotten a little bit out of hand, and as such, you'll notice that every single antenna advertisement in QST Magazine does not have a gain claim. QST will not allow you to put down the number of decibels. They soon realized that everybody was fibbing. The whole thing became such a great big lie that they decided that nobody's allowed to claim gain anymore. Let me drop. So when Mosley claimed 8, I think they were really getting 7, but 7 is not bad. That's about a 5-to-1 power ratio. If you could see that antenna pattern out of that antenna, it would be a great big fat watermelon-shaped pattern in three-dimensional space, where that watermelon has around an 85-degree beamwidth, azimuth and elevation on the forward lobe, and a reasonably good, if they claimed 15 or 20 decibels of front-to-back ratio as a laboratory measurement, yes. There's a deep notch there that could be off the back like the apple pattern where the stem goes. You've got a deep notch, and there could be a pretty deep notch back there. Do you really get it in real world when the signal off the back of the antenna is arriving at a 30-degree angle above the horizon? maybe that notch in the real world is not going to be that deep. But could it really have a 7 dB of gain, a 5-to-1 ratio? Absolutely. Therefore, you put 100 watts into the antenna, and the guy listening to you will think it's 500 watts you're transmitting. That's real. Three-element Yagi can do that. So I may have made you overly pessimistic, and there really is a little bit of Santa Claus, if you know what I mean there, Bernie. K2, Mike Uniform, K2RIW on the TechNet.
AC2QIQ with a comment.
Bernie first. Go ahead, Bernie.
Yeah, okay. So, okay, I'm with you so far, Dick. And maybe Glenn, you can clear this up between the two of you. So where is that gain coming from? If it's not coming from the boom length, let's say on 20 meters, 12 feet is not a long enough boom length. So where is that gain coming from if it's not coming from the Yagi effect?
It is the Yagi effect. And when it comes to only three elements, some rather small spacings can give you quite a bit of performance. Not ideal, but an awful lot of it. So I think that antenna, at least on some of those bands, 10 and 15, could easily have had over 7 dB of gain over isotropic, maybe even 7.5. Let's see what Glenn thinks. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Yeah, Dick, these antennas, I've looked into them, and I think the word lie is probably apropos. What will happen is at 10 meters, with a 12-foot boom on 10 meters, you could probably claim at least 6, maybe a little bit more than 6. Then you look at, like, say, 15, and it's probably 5 or 4.5, and at 20 meters, you're pretty much talking about a rotatable dipole. With a little bit of more rejection than a dipole off the back of the beam, but most of the null is really to the side on 20 meters. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
And even on 20 meters, where you're not getting quite all of that gain, you're not getting 7 or 8 dB of gain, you're getting something considerably less, you still could be getting a pretty deep notch off the back and a pretty nice front-to-back ratio. Now, that Mosley antenna, if you go to the right website, probably somebody has put one on a real antenna range and really measured it. That's one choice. Another choice is you're well within the capability of modern-day available computer modeling programs, NEC, MINI-NEC, and whatever. You could plug in the dimensions of those elements into that program and find out the real gain. The computer modeling programs, when it comes to things like Yagi's with conventional diameter of the elements, the computer modeling programs can do a beautiful job. As you guys have heard me say on another subject, let me drop. There's a whole class of antennas that I've been working with for the last 10 years that you cannot computer model them with the currently available programs, because I use elements that are so fat that the finite elements would be so large. And it's a complex element, it's a complex array, a complex matrix. In other words, you'd have to model it with hundreds of little triangles in the finite element, and each one of those triangles has an amplitude and a phase, and all of that great big matrix would have to be invertible in order for the computer program to calculate what's really going on. So there's a whole class of antennas that you can easily find by cut-and-try testing techniques with a good anechoic range and a good vector network analyzer, and I've done that work. But when it comes to relatively simple Yagi, the TA-33 is one of those. I'm pretty sure that could be modeled, and you could find out the exact gain if you wanted to know. It's a little bit, let me drop. It's a little bit academic. If Glenn told you that the gain on 20 meters for the TA-33 is 4.5 dB over isotropic, and if you modeled it and found out it's 4.75, it's in the same ballpark. But it does have some real gain. It's got some real front-to-back ratio. It's worth pursuing. It's worth doing. When it comes to modeling, you maybe have done more modeling than I have. I've done very little antenna modeling. You can tell that I don't have very much faith in it for the class of antennas that I've been working with. I know the model doesn't work. I've had a couple of very successful antennas, some of which I have patented, and you try applying the best available computer modeling programs, and the program basically says, I can't handle that. It says tilt. So when it comes to this antenna, I'm reasonably sure it can be modeled. Let's see what Glenn thinks on that one. KC2QIQ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Good, Dick. They can definitely be modeled, and as I said, what you'll find out is the same thing I did the hard way, and realistically, you find out just by even talking to guys on the band, and you find out who's using what and what kind of signal strength, and you'll find out the same way that I did, that pretty much the guys who are really at the big signals on HF, most of the time, and you ask them about their antennas, usually their Yagis on HF are homebrew. And you'll find out that they went to DX Engineering, made their antennas, and their booms, depending, in other words, they'll build a Yagi for each band. If they left 10, they'll build the Yagi to 10. And usually just to break that 6 dB gain to 7, getting close to 8, you have to have a boom that's pretty much one wavelength long. So in other words, if the boom isn't at least one wavelength, it's hard to break that 7 dB mark. So the guys that are like 7 and 8 dB, on HF bands, their booms are at least one wavelength long. And if they're doing it on 10, 15, and 20, you'll see big QSL cards, and you'll see a big tower, and on there, they've got a Yagi for each band. K2IW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, the band who arguably is the world's best modern-day living Yagi expert is DL7WU, I think it's called. It is our Gunter Hawk, Dr. Gunter Hawk, Darmstadt, Germany, DL7 Whiskey Uniform. He has had a whole bunch of articles on Yagi antennas of all the brand names. What he has done over the last 30 years of his life, he's taken the world's best Yagi designs on HF, VHF, and UHF frequencies and made a scale model of each one of them at either 432 or 1296 megacycles. During the time he was working for the German Federal Post Office in Darmstadt, Germany, he had access to a great big anechoic chamber. Let me drop. And in those days when he was beginning that work 30 years ago, the computer modeling programs of today didn't exist. So he did it in real life. He built a scale model of each one of these antennas. One of the nice things about an antenna is that if the original antenna was designed for 28 megahertz and you decide to scale up by 10 to 1, build every single dimension of every element and every boom and whatever, turn everything down by 10 to 1 ratio, the 28 megacycle antenna is now a 200 megacycle antenna. Antennas, even very elaborate Yagi antennas, they scale beautifully. You build a scale model where you change every one of the dimensions proportional to wavelength, and you've now got the exact same antenna of a higher frequency where his anechoic chamber had good performance. He would put it in that chamber and really measured it. So he came up with a whole bunch of graphs of what is achievable in gain versus number of elements and length of boom. What he soon discovered, let me drop. When it comes to the maximum available peak forward gain, it's primarily a function of the length of the boom. And there's a whole bunch of designs for that length of boom where you've got a minimum number of elements along that boom or a whole bunch of elements along that boom. You'll end up with very close to the same gain. So length of boom is the primary factor. And he's got a very well-respected formula where you tell a guy how many wavelengths long is the boom, and assuming it's got a reasonable number of elements in there. You're not stacking so fewer elements that you've got a wavelength between them. If you've got something in the vicinity of 4/10 of a wavelength of distance between the elements, and you've got a known length of boom in wavelengths, let me drop. His formula will predict for you exactly what gain you're going to get with an accuracy of a couple of tenths of a dB. I've used that formula lots of times. Works very well. So Gunter Hawk is the man, and so length of boom is it. And as such, you could plug in each one of your 10, 15, and 20 meters and 12 foot of boom, and you could calculate exactly what gain is likely to be derived or realized, if you know what I mean. Another thing to know about is that if, for instance, I've got a Yagi that's got elements on it for 20 meters and is working like a charm, and now in between those elements, I decide to stack some elements on 15 meters, the elements on 15 meters will see the local tip capacitance of the nearby 20-meter elements. Therefore, they will be electronically tuned to a slightly lower frequency. Let me drop. And if I'm smart enough to shorten those elements on 15 meters a little bit to compensate for that, to bring my parasitic elements on 15 meters back to the desired resonant frequency, I can now have an antenna with full performance on 20 meters and full performance on 15 meters with all the elements on the exact same boom simultaneously. One does not have to degrade the other. And if you're smart enough, you can do that three times in a row. You can have the elements on there for 20 meters, elements for 15 meters, elements for 10 meters, and each one of those antennas on each one of those bands will give you essentially full performance. You don't have to make them completely separate Yagis if you don't want to. It's simpler to do it that way, but you don't have to. So once again, this antenna is fully modelable if you want to. And as I said, it's a little bit academic. You know it's 12-foot of boom. You plug it into the Gunter-Hawk formula, which I don't have in front of me right now, but I can get it for you, and that you'll know within a couple of tenths of a dB what gain you most likely really have. K2, Mike Uniform, for any other comments. K2LIW, go ahead, Bernie.
K2QIQ with another comment.
Okay, let me take Glenn first before I go back to Bernie for a fill. Go ahead, Glenn.
The method that you just mentioned, Dick, works beautiful on VHF, UHF, and those bands, because when you look at the height of the antenna off the ground and the radial horizon and wavelengths that you recall from the ground, if you want to put 2 meters and 70 centimeters and 220 all on one boom, even if you have 900 megahertz on there and 1 gig, you can probably get them all on one boom and probably space them apart, and it's going to work just like you said. And you can have a beautiful multi-band Yagi, probably on one boom. I've never done it, but I would imagine it's going to work. But the problem with 20 meters and 10 meters and 40 meters and these bands are that the wavelengths in terms of feet off the ground, in other words, if you wanted to have directionality and good radio horizon on a beam, the height that you'd have to be off the ground in order to get the polarization and everything to work properly are all going to be at different heights, unless you want to go for the maximum height. So if you were going to use, let's say, 20 meters and you wanted to be one wavelength off the ground, with at least a boom length of at least one wavelength, think about all the weight that you'd have on one boom at that height. That's the problem, Dick. That's why you don't see it that often. Usually you see that the beams are stacked at different heights for each band on single monoband Yagis. K2IW, KC2QIQ.
Okay, Glenn, you made it sound like there's a weight limitation. If I use thin enough wall tubing, and I'm not trying to survive in ice form, I can keep the weight of that Yagi down. And if the Yagi on 20 meters, if my resources don't allow me to put a 20-meter Yagi more than 60 feet above the ground, that's a good antenna. It's not perfect, not the right number of wavelengths, that's still a darn good antenna. And now if I had a completely separate 15-meter Yagi, 60 feet above the ground, and a completely separate 10-meter Yagi, 60 feet above the ground, you know what kind of performance I'm going to get. It's not perfect, but it's darn good. It's worth seeking. Now if I take those completely separate Yagis on 20 meters, 15 meters, and 10 meters, each of which was going to be mounted 60 feet above the ground on three separate towers, and now if I can control the weight, control the wind load, particularly with a weather vane, so I do wind balancing, I'm convinced I can put the 20, the 15, and the 10-meter Yagi on that same boom and mount it above 60 feet above the ground and get the exact same performance I would have with three separate towers, all 60 foot tall, on those three bands for that one Yagi. Wonder if you agree with that, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
I agree with you, Dick. It's just how much money do you want to spend and how much concrete and how much steel do you have? I mean, really. I mean, and as I said, most people usually get it backwards. They tend to put the small antenna on the top and the big antenna on the bottom, when usually it's the other way around. In other words, when you have your 20-meter antenna, you want that one up on the top, and your 10-meter antenna can be below your 20-meter antenna, and your 15-meter antenna can be in between. Because, in other words, you really would love to be one wavelength off the ground. Chances are you'll get fairly decent performance at a half a wavelength across above the ground. So to achieve it on 10 meters to get to one wavelength is not the hardest thing in the world. So to mount that one is not so bad. But when you start getting to 20 meters and getting that one a wavelength off the ground, that's kind of like the limitation for most people on Long Island. Now to do 80 meters, you kind of see where the problem comes in. Now you got to be up at 250 feet. With the antenna, it just, after a while, it's just like, you know, where do you draw the line? KTRW, KC2QIQ. However, that Weinstock family in Bayside, they've got resources. They've got friends that have got good mechanical engineering and good aeronautic engineering for the aerodynamics. It can be done. Don't say it can't be done. Without a doubt, it's difficult. Glenn is telling you where the minefield is, but if you apply enough technology, I know you can do this, Bernie, if you want to bad enough. K2MU for a final, K2RIW.
Okay, well, it's very illuminating where, you know, it all started with that loop thing. Is it gain or is it not? It looks like it's gain, but it's just a gain relative to the notch. But in any case, let's see. I'll tell you this about the last thing about the beam, though. I think we all realize, though, that, a Yagi has to be at the right height with the right spacing between the elements for it to work exactly, you know, for it to work well, and everything else is some kind of compromise. And I did check out that picture of the 80-meter beam, and that is impressive. But in any case, I will say this about the three-element beam, and I don't work for the Moseley Company, but that beam went up in 1978, and up until last year, Hurricane Sandy, it was up there perfectly, withstood everything and was perfect. And after Hurricane Sandy, the director is a little knocked sideways from the wind, loosened up after, I don't know how many years that is, 78 to... a lot of years. So well-built antenna, and it definitely is fun. Even at 40 feet, it's very effective. Of course, it's not like one of the big guns with the huge antennas and antenna farms, but it is definitely more effective than a regular dipole or vertical in most cases, was my experience. So more on homebrew antennas later. Appreciate it, Dick. And Glenn, those three, it was mostly an illusion, so there is no Santa Claus, not at least your wavelength above the ground, etc. So back to you, Dick, K2MU.
KC2QIQ with the final comment, Dick.
Very fine. Glenn, in a minute, we may have overly pessimistized, if you know what I mean, you, Bernie. It's not quite that bad. To get full performance, you'd like to be halfway, one wavelength above the ground. And if your resources only allows you to go a quarter wavelength above the ground, it doesn't mean it's going to catch on fire and explode and stop working. It's going to get slightly degraded performance. And if you're willing to go over the vertical polarization, you can get some of it back, even though mechanically it's more difficult. It's not quite as bad as we've led you to believe. KC2QIQ, K2RIW, Greg Glenn.
Yeah, Dick, I just wanted to elaborate on what you just said, that, you know, just because we're talking about academically here of where real gain is coming from, the heights to get good, proper radio horizon, proper polarization and, true polarimetry, in other words, what's real vertical, what's real horizontal, yes, you've got to be at those heights. You need those boom lengths. You need that, but just to have fun as a good amateur. If you've got an antenna, a tri-element beam at 40, 45 feet, let me let it drop. And And that's the antenna that I'm using. I don't have an antenna that's up at 150 feet. I'd love to. I'd love to have a 250-foot tower and have gain on 80. I don't. I mean, I'm operating basically 10 through 20 at about 45 feet. And I work the world. But the interesting thing is that I really can't trust, you know, a lot of the, you know, the conditions all the time. I work with the notches on the side of the beam to and filters in on the receiver. So between filters in my receiver and positioning the beam so I can notch out the strong signals to the side of me, especially that are like only a kilohertz and a half away, you know, you can work the world and have a lot of fun doing it. Back to you, Dick. K2IW, KC2QIQ.
One of the earlier questions that Barry asked is that the full wavelength loop, does it have gain? Yes, it does. He was about to ask me how many dB of gain. I'm not sure. But that full wavelength loop really is a kind of pair of half wavelength antennas all run together. Each one's a half wavelength dipole, and one's a quarter wavelength ahead of the other, so to speak. And the ends are bent down in one dipole and bent up on the other. You know what a cubical quad antenna would look like. A cubical quad antenna is a full wavelength driven element. And if you take that cubical quad driven element and lay it parallel to the ground, that is the full wavelength loop antenna. And the antenna pattern, a little bit more difficult to figure out, but it does have some gain. I'm not sure, but if someone told me it's got 3 dB of gain over isotropic in the most desirable directions, I believe it. It could very well be doing that. Okay. I know we got way off to one side, John, but maybe you've got another one. And even though it's a little bit late for these guys that can't stay up this late, it will eventually appear as a recording. All of these tech nets get recorded. Let me drop them. I heard somebody say mobile. I'll pick you up in a minute. All of them get recorded at www.amateurradio.tangovictor. And so the last 6.5 years of technical nets, with one or two exceptions every week, are there. And so you choose the right year, the right month, the right weekend, and start downloading those audio in 1 hour reels. You can listen to all of the past tech nets. And there are people who put that into their recording machine and listen to it while they're on the train, driving to work, on their lunch hour, whatever, because they can't stay up that late. These tech nets all begin at 8 o'clock and usually end at midnight. And so and the machine gets turned off at midnight at my request, because other than that, some of these guys would go until the sun rises. Who is the person who said mobile? Give me a call, letters, K2LIW.
X7EW.
Go ahead, Howie.
I'll tell you that we're playing around with an inverted V over at Barry's house. I don't know if Barry told you. We put a 10-meter receiver in his house with a link back to my system. And we built an inverted V. We're getting some interesting stuff. We got no local coverage, but we're getting some decent skip. But we're fighting a big noise problem. And we're trying to, back to you, the K4RIW. We got the antenna. Barry's got the antenna at 70 feet. Go ahead.
Yeah, good sounding antenna. And Barry lives in a pretty close. Barry is in one of the 5 boroughs of New York City, which is arguably one of the most dense RF environments on planet Earth. There's a chance you guys will get a little bit of improvement on the local noise with the right kind of a noise blanker. I'd like to believe that some of the noise is arcing of high-voltage insulators on Con Ed power transformers and things like that. So you think you're getting what, like S3 noise? Howie, go ahead.
The S9, S8 power line. I'm thinking about going to some kind of a phasing unit. What do you think about using a phasing unit? Barry don't think a phasing unit would work. Something in which we use another antenna and a piece of equipment to basically monitor the signal and phase it out. This is being done at FM. Now, the noise can be pretty tough. By the way, you know, I'm thinking about putting up another inverted V, taking 2 inverted Vs, as I've already discussed with you, in a totally different direction. And I'm going to phase them not with 75-ohm, but two 50-ohm cables, and then go into an antenna tuner. Because if I take two inverted V's, I'll have 50 ohms. Keep the cable length the same. But I'm thinking about pulling out with a phasing unit. What's your recommendation on a phasing unit, Dick?
Okay, lots of things you could mean by phasing. Is it RF phasing between the individual elements? Is it phasing with reference to the 60-cycle line? Quite possibly the greatest amount of noise is coming from things that are striking on each half of the 60 cycles, 120 pulses per second of fluorescent lighting and sodium arc lighting on the Southern State Parkway. There's all kinds of sources of noise in Barry's neighborhood. And each one of those individual bulbs is firing on 120 times per second at a slightly different number of degrees of the Con Ed power line. The chances of you phasing that out are very slim. It's worth a try, but I think it's a long shot. Howie, go ahead.
What I will tell you is that trying to listen to DS is getting very tough. I need a noise level to be S9, 10 over 9. So we were thinking about trying. I was thinking about a phasing unit. DS Engineering sells a unit that allows you to hook up and allows you to tune out noise. But I've been told those units don't work that well. Go ahead.
You might be right. I haven't heard any good news. I don't own one of those. And I do know that certain kinds of cancelers, impulse noise cancelers, was one of these set of experiments that K2KEY Mel was running. And he did get some success out of that by adding a canceler network to his loop antennas that were steerable in X, Y, and Z in the basement of his house, a receiving loop antenna. So his canceler gave him some improvement. Not night and day, but it's worth a try. Let me go back to John. And although we're running a little bit late, John, if you've got another one, go for it, because I think by way of the recording, these guys can still get to the data. It'll just be a week later. KC2GW. Here we go. Boy, am I getting... WGB, KC2WGB. Who are you again, John? K2RIW, the TechNet. Go ahead.
KC2WGB. I forgot who I am. That's all right. It doesn't matter. Very good. You know, one question. Look what it led to. You know, going from differential mode to this. Okay. Well, all that information is good to have. All right. My next, I'm going to pick a simple one here. All right. Got a young ham here. No, young scientist. He wants to know what causes the light emission in an LED diode. Is it chemical? Is it heat? Why is it when you put a voltage there on a solid state device, light comes out? I'm glad Glenn's here too, because I know he's got some, and maybe he has some words on it also. So back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
Wow. I think it's the solid-state equivalent of a plasma. In the case of a neon tube, you really are ionizing the gas, the neon, inside that partially evacuated tube with a small amount of neon in there. And so those electrons are being separated from those nucleuses of those of the neon atoms, and the electrons are flowing in one direction, and the resultant ions are flowing in the other direction on each half cycle. And it's a real breakdown. It's a high voltage breakdown in that gas, and it's a real plasma. And does a light-emitting diode in the solid-state world do something equivalent? I'm not sure. Now, Glenn has worked on light-emitting diodes for a lot of years, and particularly the power supplies for them. So, Glenn, from your point of view, what's the easiest way of explaining where the light is coming from in a light-emitting diode? I know it really is a kind of a laser. KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, basically, from what my understanding, talking to the scientists at Cree, who do most of the work with them, their best, let me say, the simplest explanation is it works very, very similar to the way a crystal, like a crystal oscillator would work. Basically what's happening is by putting a DC bias of current across this wafer of silicon in the forward direction, basically what happens is the silicon wafer actually vibrates at the frequency of light and creates luminescence. And the more current that you apply, basically you create a stronger vibration, and that vibration is at the frequency of light and creates the color band. So that specific color band is associated to the density and the thickness of the wafer itself. So probably the closest thing, although, you know, the material of a crystal is ceramic, and the material of the diode is really silicon, it's more the properties of that silicon with the current through it that makes it vibrate at the frequency of light. So is there really a gas reaction? Not really. This is more of a solid state converting current to light frequency directly in the material. K2RW, KC2QIQ.
Now, since you've built power supplies for these things, Glenn, you probably know, is there a slight negative impedance characteristic of the light-emitting diode itself? If I slightly increase the current or decrease the current from the normal operating position, so to speak, and I plot voltage drop across the diode for that amount of current, is it a positive resistor or a negative resistor? Is it a little bit like a tunnel diode? If it had negative resistance, slightly higher current would make a slightly lower voltage drop across the device, in which case you'd have to be kind of careful in the way you design the power supply so you don't get a runaway condition, particularly as a function of temperature. So I wonder if it has a little bit of that characteristic, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2LAW in the TechNet.
Yeah, the correct modeling of the LED is it follows all the same characteristics of silicon diodes. So although the voltage drop is considerably higher, the characteristic is as current increases, the voltage drop is increasing. So it is a positive coefficient. It's not negative. And so more current, more voltage drop. And this is true of basically all diodes, with one exception, in certain cases, the Schottky diode. And the Schottky diode does the same thing. It has that positive coefficient, but as the temperature of the Schottky diode is increasing, the voltage drop starts to drop. It becomes lower at higher temperature. But to really answer the question correctly, as current is increasing, the voltage drop is increasing, provided the temperature is constant. K2IW, KC2QIQ.
In the case of a light-emitting diode, does the voltage drop decrease with higher temperature? And therefore, of the power supplies you designed, did you tend to make them more constant current supplies rather than constant voltage supplies in order to compensate for various temperatures of the light-emitting diode? Over to you, Glenn, K2LAW.
In most cases, Dick, the primary concern with the light-emitting diode is the chromescence. In other words, you want to get the correct frequency of light and for the wafer. So in most cases, the current is constant. So to keep constant current in the LED is really what's king. The other thing is, as far as temperature compensation, in most cases, the idea there is to do the best possible heat sinking to make sure that you don't have a temperature rise that will damage the diode. So in most cases where you see heat sinking taking place on the LEDs, it's usually to keep the LED in a safe operating condition, and the constant current is maintained to get the correct chrominance color. K2RW, KC2QIQ.
And similar to all solid-state devices, if you can keep the temperature down, my guess is the life goes up very fast. And if you're doing a poor design where the diode runs hot, my guess is you start chopping into the life of the thing real fast. Now, when you talked about chromescence, as I go to higher or lower current than the design current, does it tend to shift toward the blue and toward the red, respectively? Is that where the chromescence tends to shift as a function of exceeding or not achieving the right amount of current? Over to you, Glenn, K2LAW.
Yeah, there is a bit of variation in that, most of which is corrected. Generally, most of the LEDs that I've seen and the curves associated with them is the frequency tends to increase with current. So what you find out is that most of the higher powered LEDs, in other words, the LEDs that give you the most amount of light, tend to be at the higher end of the frequency curve, and they're also usually the ones running at the higher currents. How that's corrected is with lensing. In other words, generally there's another material like a yellowing effect that gets placed on top to basically bring the color back to what's more referred to as like the warm white color.
Now, that yellowing effect, is that a filter or is that a fluorescent material? In other words, is there a kind of material that the light-emitting diode ultraviolet portion hits it and it emits red light, and with the right amount of red added to the LED output, the eye now sees it as a warmer? Is there some of that action going on in some of these LEDs, Glenn, K2LIW?
Exactly, Dick. That's pretty much what's happening. It really is a filter, and the filter does recombine in the most efficient way the frequency output of the light into the warm light or warm white region, where it's a much more pleasant light, where the unfiltered one tends to look more like a bluish kind of harsh color. K2RHW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, my favorite green light-emitting diode pointer. What's really going on inside is that it's got a very fancy crystal that has a frequency doubling. The real light-emitting diode in there, and the more efficient light-emitting diodes, the earlier designs, happen to be infrared. So there's an infrared light-emitting diode. The signal coming out of it hits this fancy crystal. The crystal doubles it up to something like 540 nanometers. The real light-emitting diode is running at 1,080 nanometers approximately. And so there are fancy crystals, there are fancy kinds of phosphor that will literally absorb at one wavelength and re-emit at another and do it with rather high efficiency. And the nice thing about a green light-emitting diode is the same number of milliwatts. You're not supposed to exceed 5 milliwatts to be eye safe. 5 milliwatts of green looks 10 times brighter than 5 milliwatts of red. If the red happens to be 670 nanometers, it's just the way the human eye operates. So you get a lot more apparent brilliance out of a green light-emitting diode. And so let me drop the simple little pointer of mine. On a dark night, the aerosols and dust particles and other things that are in the air will make it act like a light sword. So if I was running an astronomy class and I wanted to point at a particular star with my light-emitting, with my green laser pointer, almost everybody in the crowd would see exactly what star I'm pointing at, even though they're not standing right alongside of me, if you know what I mean. So they're kind of handy. KC2, WGB, K2RIW. Go ahead, John.
KC2, WGB. And that came from a 15-year-old. I think that was an excellent question. Okay. Well, we better get over to Paul, and that's it from the mailbag. And thanks to everyone who participated. Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
Yeah, between you and me, John, we didn't quite answer his question. Where is the light really coming from? There's some kind of magic in the very specifically fabricated silicon that's inside of a light-emitting diode, and there's a lot more going on. There's fancy layers in there with just the right thicknesses of the layers. And so it's a diode-like action, and I think it's a forward bias diode, Schottky-like diode. But I'd like to believe there were some websites that give a better explanation than we did tonight. We gave a little information, but what's really going on at the atomic level, I don't think we answered that question. And maybe we'll try a little more next week. Paul, what has NASA been doing? And what's the latest on the... I think it's the Chinese lander that's going to be landing on the moon, if it hasn't already done so. WS2N, K2LIW. Go ahead, Paul.
Okay, very good, Dick. This is WS2N. They call that Jade Rabbit. Jade Rabbit. That's an interesting project that's kept pretty secret for a long time, and only in the last few months they really released pictures. And within, let's see, the other day was 10, probably 8 days now from now, they plan on going into orbit and then landing on the moon. And then soon after landing, they're going to release a rover, a 308-pound rover. Drive around on the moon with instruments on board. It's got a radar to penetrate 200 meters below the surface. It's got four cameras. The lander itself is going to be stationary. That has a telescope on board to look at the middle of the galaxy. So they're going full blast, and they have plans on future lunar landing missions and eventually manned missions. I mean, that's their goal. Some people are thinking that the next steps on the moon will be the Chinese, with the Chinese flag. So we got to get on the stick here. Let me drop it. European Space Agency launched a rocket 10 years ago called the Rosetta. I remember talking about that a little bit on the net. When that went up, it was launched from French Guiana by an Ariane 5 rocket that's there, a heavy lift vehicle. And it went through many gravity assists, three Earth gravity assists, and one Mars gravity assist to get to a comet. And they're closing in on it now. It was going to take about 10 years to get there. Right now, the Rosetta spacecraft is asleep. You know, they went to a sleep mode after testing Mars, testing equipment. They pretty much shut everything down. But they're going to bring it back. They're going to wake it up in January, a couple of weeks from now. And in May of this year, it will go into orbit, not just past one of these comets. It's going to actually orbit it. It's a comet 67P with a big long name, two long names of the people that discovered it years ago. So, not being outdone, they are going to launch a lander from the Rosetta spacecraft and land on the comet. It's got these harpoon type of action that when the lander comes down, it's going to pierce the comet, and this way it will hold itself to the comet for a number of reasons. They don't want it to go anywhere. They don't want it really to bounce. And the other reason is they have a drill on board. They want to drill about, they gave it in centimeters, but I think it's about 8 inches into the ground. To see what it's made of. It's got about 10 instruments on board the lander. Everything is solar paneled. Solar panel on the lander, solar panel on the Rosetta spacecraft, which will be in orbit above. And that'll be acting as a repeater. And this thing is coming toward the sun, and it plans on staying in orbit as it gets near the sun, goes around the sun, and starts heading back out all the way to Jupiter. That's the planned mission time, which would put it at the end of 2015. It's an interesting flight by ESA, the European Space Agency, called the Rosetta mission. The lander, by the way, is called Philae, P-H-I-L-A-E, is the name of the lander. Another thing I want to bring up, and we're short on time, so I'll try to go quick, is the SpaceX Falcon 9 Orbital Science SES-8 mission, which I've been talking about, it seems like forever, because they've had three scrubs over the last month or so. They finally did get off the launch pad, launch complex 40 that they actually bought up really from the government. I mean, they rebuilt this whole launch pad, and they use it for themselves. They finally got off the pad last Tuesday, and I got a chance to watch it on the computer. NASA doesn't put it on their NASA TV. And the reason being, it's a commercial flight. It's a commercial company that's putting it into orbit, paying SpaceX. Orbital Science, another commercial company, built the satellite, the SES-8.
and they put it up into geosynchronous orbit, first time a private company ever did that, for a company in Luxembourg that's paying for everything.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
ExactTV is it's a webcast. Comes on about a half hour before the flight. We drop it. This is WS2N. So, their improved Falcon 9, they call it the 9.1.1 version of the original Falcon 9. The other ones they've used for testing, they've used to send cargo to the International Space Station. But this the upgraded one. This is about 60% larger than that. It successfully launched in California about a month or so ago for the first time. And again, it's a successful launch from Florida. This time they got down to the zero count with no problem. The other days they had all kinds of problems. One time there was oxygen in the igniter line that they have. I have the information on that if you want that. What kind of gases and everything involved in that. How that reacts. It's just a gas that when it gets in the presence of air or oxygen will actually ignite. They use that for an igniter. Even so, the first stage and second stage, they run on the same chemicals there. The RP-1 is the kerosene, refined kerosene, and they run on liquid oxygen. But to light this stuff, they have these igniters, and some oxygen got into the line, and computers picked that up, and that's why it shut down at one time. So this time it went fine, and now they're preparing for another launch. They're for next, they want to get it off.